Good afternoon. I'd like to bring the House Committee on Business and Labor to order Monday, March 6. We have a pretty full agenda today. My intent will be to start with House Bill 2193 first, and we're going to spend an hour, no more, on this bill. It may end up truncating some that wish to testify, but we're going to do our best to get a balanced hearing, and I'm sure we'll have more conversations available in the future. So with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2193.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is a measure that establishes a right of workers to express a schedule preference free from fear of retaliation or discrimination, but it does not require the employers to honor all schedule requests. It also requires all employers to compensate workers who report to work when their shift is canceled or reduced within 24 hours of the scheduled start. The measure provides that employers with 25 or more employees in Oregon and 100 employees nationwide who are in the retail, food establishment, and hotel-motel sectors, that they be subject to additional provisions, including providing a good faith estimate of the average hours per week and expectations for on-call shifts, for advance notice of schedules, for predictability pay when schedules change, employee rights to discuss scheduling preferences with the employer, and to rest between shifts, and to access additional hours before new employees are hired. A worker asserting a violation under the measure can file a complaint with BOLI or file a civil action. There are no amendments today before you.
Thank you, and I know there's been a lot of conversations about amendments, but another little bit of background. This issue came up last session, 2015, I believe, and we did have a work group over the interim on these issues where a lot of these issues were talked about, and the proponents have drafted this bill for introduction. So with that, let's start off with a public hearing. We'll call up, is that Michaela Steinmetz, Mark Helen, and Naomi Mendoza? And I forgive you if I pronounced your name wrong.
That is totally okay.
You'd introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony. Thank you.
My name is Michaela Steinmetz. And thank you so much for letting me speak with you today. I have been in the restaurant industry as a host and a server for 3.5 years. And my experience greatly illustrates why this Fair Work Week bill needs to be passed. House Bill 2193 is recently addressed. I would like to begin with speaking about employer retaliation for a change in work schedule. After about a year and a half of working, I presented to a manager of mine a change in my availability due to my pursuit in higher education. It constricted 2 nights a week that I needed to take for classes. I was immediately told by my manager that they were starting to let employees go who had restricted availability. I was confused and afraid because my classes would only be for 3 months, so almost a full term. I gave them 1 month's notice to start accommodating, and I knew of several other employees who had even more limited schedules that were more readily accommodated. This uncertainty is difficult to plan around, especially for families who are working to support their children, their spouses, and for those who are trying to pursue a higher education. Secondly, I would like to address the issue of changing shifts with less than 2 weeks' notice. In my experience, I can speak to less than 24 hours of notice. Over the summer, I work as a henna artist at a local farmer's market during the day, and then I work as a server during the night. One day I was on call at 4 o'clock, and I received a call in the morning changing my schedule. And then over the next hour, I received 3 more phone calls changing my schedule, all within the span of 3 hours, from the original start time to the time I got by the end. And that was very difficult because I couldn't just get up and leave my job that I was at currently to go to work the next day, or to go to work that evening, excuse me. This makes my job very stressful to plan other activities. And I also have experience with having my schedule changed day of and receiving no call. That is so important to realize. When I don't receive a call day of my schedule being changed and I either show up early or late, I get in trouble for that. And that's difficult when you have a busy life, when you're working, when you're raising children, when you're doing other things. And this sort of fickleness makes my daily activities and my other life extremely difficult. We need to be able to improve these kinds of conditions, because there's the thought that, you know, if you don't like this job, go and get a different job. That's not the reality for most people that work in these industries, that most people that work in lines of work like this. These jobs are more readily available in the economy, as it were, and a lot of these people can't get up. They can't go out and find another job. They are in the process of trying to pay for their education. They're trying to raise their families and create a life outside of their work. So this isn't an issue of any sort of entitlement. This is an issue of, we want to be able to work and have the work that we are promised, and not be afraid to wonder, am I going to make my rent this week? Am I going to make my rent this month? Am I going to make wages to pay for my education, to get another job, or to support my family and raise my children? This is important, and most people that work in this industry now, today in 2017, simply don't have that luxury. And it's so important to be able to have that accommodated. We want to work. We want to be with our employers. We like it. I can personally speak, I love serving. I love what I do. But I need to be able to be assured that I have the hours that I have been given, and receive no retaliation from my managers, to receive no sort of ill treatment because of a change in my schedule due to education, due to family, due to other aspects in life. And I want it to be known that there's a lot of inconsistency between employees. Some employees might have the same or more restrictive schedules, and their treatment is different than the treatment that other employees might get that might not be as bold to speak up. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Go ahead. Just enter.
Chairman, Vice Chair, members of the committee, thanks for letting me speak. My name is Mark Halen. I'm a bartender in Southeast Portland, and I really urge you to pass through. This is House Bill 2193. In the beginning of 2015, I had an amazing full-time job working every shift Thursday night through Sunday night at a sports bar. And it was amazing. I absolutely loved it. I then had a scheduling conflict where I thought I could make a reasonable request to ask for my Thursday night shift to be switched to Wednesday. The next schedule came out. We always got them on Saturdays for the next Sunday through Saturday week. And I was given 12 hours on shifts I was normally not even available for. I quickly changed my plans, worked those two downtime shifts that were no games, no tips, just prep. I made $93 that week. It was an 80% pay cut from what I was used to. I confronted my manager about this schedule, and they said that it's January, it's going to be slow, we're going to have to try something new around here. I've been in the service industry for 10 years, I'm well aware that that is a very common thing to have happen, so I went with it. The next Saturday, the schedule came out, and I had two shifts again on two different days I was not normally available. And the manager then told me that we all have to make sacrifices when it's slow. The third week, I had three shifts instead of my normal seven. And that was three shifts in which I was training a new bar manager that they were hiring because they had too many hours they needed to fill. I trained this bar manager, and then they were given control of the schedule. They were allowed the flexibility to do whatever they wanted, and my schedule and the other bartenders were punished by it. She worked every major game, which is where you make your money in tips, where we were all stuck working prep and cleaning up after her. I used all of my savings that I'd saved up when I was working full-time to make sure I could pay rent, pay bills, and afford anything in my life. If I hadn't saved up that money, I would have been another homeless person in Portland. I did find another bartending gig. They gave me a schedule almost a week in advance so I could tell my old bar manager when I was working so I could try to do the two jobs. Within the first week of that, of me letting them know my schedule, they claimed that it was too difficult to plan my schedule around my second job. I was All of my hours were cut. I remained on the schedule for 11 weeks with 0 hours. They refused to let me go. But that's how it works. Everything's okay now, but that is not a very good thing. It's a poor business practice. Managers can definitely abuse their power. Most managers in the state don't. Most managers are moral and fair people that want to treat all of their employees right. But unfortunately, the law does not require them to, so they can abuse their workers' schedules. To managers, it's just hours, but to us, it's income. We need to be able to plan our lives, be able to make a budget, especially in an industry with tips. That is very, very important to know how much money you're going to have. We need to know what we're going to be able to do without having to drop our plans with a day in advance, 10 hours in advance. I found out an hour after my shift was supposed to end, my relief was not coming in, and they had changed the schedule, and I was supposed to continue working a double. If we're planning for upward mobility, trying to move on in our life, and we have no ability to plan, it's impossible. It's a poverty trap. And, you know, I don't need a guaranteed schedule, but I need to know it in advance so I can plan. I think all Oregonians do as well. You shouldn't be able to just shove someone aside in a case of favoritism. Currently, businesses have all of the freedom and security when it comes to scheduling, and workers have none. And I just believe we should find a balance. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair, co-chairs, and members of the committee, my name is Noemi Mendoza. I'm here in support of the Fair Work Week bill. This is for me and many other people.
Could you move the mic just a little bit closer?
Yeah.
That's good.
This is for me and many other people who are either afraid to speak or feel like their voices not matter. I have seen mothers who come into retail hoping for a better work environment and good hours to support their family. My parents, who immigrated from Mexico, spent a lot of time in the fields. They would be bent over for hours trying to fill buckets of strawberries as fast as they could. Those were not easy working conditions. I have seen women who come into retail and are happy that they get to work indoors where they are not exposed to chemicals or unbearable weather. Being exposed to such toxins can cause health issues. Women who have children try to avoid that type of environment for the sake of their children. We want to live as long and happy and healthy to see our children grow. These same women are afraid to complain about their schedule when they do not get enough hours, have their shifts cut, or have last-minute scheduling. They are happy they have a job that does not require being outdoors, but at the same time afraid to speak up about unfair scheduling. It is not okay to neglect that they have families, and predictable scheduling can help in the success of healthy families. When I had an inconsistent schedule at work, it would stress my family and myself because I had a little one and I had to plan my days around work and their time. We want time with our family and the right to know our hours so that we can pay our bills and not have to plan our lives around an unpredictable schedule. I urge you to pass House Bill 2193. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony today to start us off with a flavor of what this bill's about. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim.
Up next, I've got Paul Paz, Diana Moadampour, and Trevor Gans. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Paul Paz. I'm a career waiter of 37 years, Oregonian. I have done most of that as a single parent. Two of my children have also worked in the business and followed my steps and have both worked in it for over 20 years each. When I first started this, one of my children became very ill with cancer and required a bone marrow transplant, and it took about 7 years to get past that. Had it not been for employers that would allow me to be available for those on-call shifts, they needed covered because somebody didn't show up, because somebody called in sick at the last moment, we would have not survived financially. They also were flexible with my schedule that allowed me to work two jobs. Again, without that flexibility, I would not have been able to survive and take care of my family financially. This particular bill would have prohibited that. I would have not been able to attend to my family's needs. Bring us up to today. My next birthday, I'm going to be 70 years old. I still work restaurant. I love it. but I'm also that to-go guy in my restaurant, that if they're short, if somebody calls in sick, somebody's late, they know who they can call to pick up that shift. With this bill, my employer would be penalized for calling me and asking me to cover that shift. So that automatically makes me a victim of this bill. There's a process called clopen, which in our industry means that you would work a night shift, you would close, you would also be opening the next day. It's a long shift. I'm not going to say it's easy, but this particular kind of schedule is extremely appealing to many of my peers, especially those that have other jobs, have families, are going to school, because they are in a very short period of time able to cram a lot of hours in and gain the income that they need in order to take care of themselves and their family. I compare the restaurant industry very similar to being a farmer, in that the crops come in, the work can be seasonal, and when the crops arrive, you got to pick them while they're there. If you don't pick them, they fall off the vine, or somebody else is going to pick them. So the nature of the business is such that you've got to be available in order to take care of the customers. The market is run by the customers. It's not run by the employers. It's not run by the employees. You've got to be able there to take care of the customers for the businesses to survive. While right now the economy is good, we forget that not so many years ago the economy crashed and there wasn't a lot of work. And the first industry that was hit really hard by this was the restaurant industry, the hospitality. We took it in the shorts, pardon my Spanish. But a lot of people were very much unemployed and hurt really bad by this. This bill would, again, restrict the availability of employees. This is a job killer. The employer I work with now, I've been with for 7 years. Started as one operation. We've done well. We are looking at our fourth location in Oregon. But we're going out of state. We're going out of state because it's getting too expensive and too hard to manage a small business here in Oregon. That means we're going to lose 100 jobs here in Oregon. I think the biggest thing is that what we do in our business is a choice. The parameters of what the industry demands of us are pretty clear. They've been established for many, many years. I do my job because it gives me opportunity, and I want to have the opportunity to take advantage of what it offers, and I believe that this bill will get in the way of doing that. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and representatives for having me today. My name is Diana Mogagdampour, and I have the pleasure of working at Gamberetti's Restaurant. I'm going on my fifth year. And what I love about my job, and I've been in this industry for 30 years being a server, is the flexibility. I'm a mother of three, and our schedule at our job is posted like 2 weeks in advance. So we know what's expected of us. We're not called off our shifts. We show up. Some of us are from start to finish because some of our other co-employees are needing to get back to their families. But I think of one instance, like if this bill does come into effect and we are only on a certain amount of hours, we're not going to be able to finish out our patrons, like from start to finish, if we have to leave within 2 hours or 3 hours or whatever our schedule is. And it's all about customer service and rapport with the server, with our customers. We don't want them to have to hurry up and leave and pay out. And I see that sometimes when you need to get off the clock. Basically, this would hinder our jobs if we, you know, are told to be there for a certain amount of hours, and we work on tips. So I guess that's basically all I need to say. A little nervous, but in essence,
did good.
That's fine. It's working for us, and I feel for the other retail people, but for servers, we pretty much have a good idea from start to finish what we need to do and when to leave and when it gets slow and to let everyone else make money in the restaurants. So that's pretty much it. Thank you so much for having me today.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
I'm going to scoot that mic over to you a little bit.
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey. Thank you for having me here. Treva Gams with Gambaretti's Italian Restaurant. I am the owner, and I do try to do everything that I can for my employees. We do post our schedule out 2 weeks. Holidays, I try to get it 3 to 4 weeks. But with that being said, there is changes, and those changes are due to everything that surrounds us. Last October, my father passed. He passed of cancer, but we had the whole family and everybody around. Well, while we had family, we wanted to do, of course, the services while everybody was there. If I had to wait 2 weeks to have the services and have catering to schedule out, that's going to put an impact on an already very trying time. So we have people that have instances within 2 weeks that they want to do an event. They want to come and bring a group. Those types of impacts where I have to bring a server in means that I'm going to have to charge a higher price because you want to bring somebody in. But sometimes we don't have the control of our environment. Last week, Tuesday, we have a group of yourselves that come into the restaurant. I'm not going to say which group, so I don't put anybody into trouble, but they had to cancel Tuesday morning for Tuesday evening. I did call that server off. I would have to now charge you for that service of those hours because you weren't able to cancel within 2 weeks, which you might have even just scheduled it the week before. So that part of bringing that in, but that server that got called off will most likely be called in for another event, hopefully, you know, Friday night. We get a lot of impact of Willamette University that comes in. They have a lot of sports teams, and they come into town, and it's, you know, the swim team here and there, that come in and they call me the night before. Can you take 20 people? Yeah, and I'll call a server. And the servers, we don't say you have to come in or do anything. It is, I have a shift. Would you like it? I have a group coming in. Would you like this? They have the opportunity to say yes or no. We have where it kind of works, checks and balances that way. But there is so much that is out of my control within a 2 weeks to try to schedule for is almost impossible. It will reflect one way or the other, whether I charge the client or it costs me, because we can't, as much as we all try within a 2 weeks to know what our schedules are, we have changes. Today, the snow. If there was an employee that could not make it in because of, some of them live in Almsville, some of them live on some very high grades, I would not want that employee to come in. I don't want them to endanger themselves. They're my family. It's very important to me that we do work with all of them. But the restrictive scheduling is going to hurt, also, like I said, where they switch shifts and they can do things. They really do control their destinies and what they want. When we had the server up here that said that he had the Thursday through Sunday, well, their schedules are up, and I usually, their schedules don't change a lot. But if somebody would ask me to change, well, I can't do this, well, I can't always take a shift away from somebody because your schedule has changed. Will I try to work with you? Absolutely I will. But I'm not going to take something from another to accommodate you. There is a check and balance of who's had that shift for how long and where are they doing and are they willing to change? Can we work it? And we ask all of those questions. But sometimes it doesn't work to the advantage of the person. So, you know, it's like, well, maybe I can do you with this shift. It may not be your ideal answer, but we will work with them. Most of the employers are, if we have happy employees, we have happy guests. So it's important to me that my staff are treated well, like their jobs, are happy where they're at. We are family, so if they have emergencies, their family comes first. They're not penalized. We let them, we cover shifts, and they'll cover each other's shifts for those reasons. I'm sorry to hear when I hear other people that the employers that are not great, and I don't think that's the average of what we have. I think we have really good people here in Oregon. And then we go into further into that bill of when somebody quits, and then I have to post and trying to get somebody to cover. We're am I going to, you know, lose business because I don't, I'm giving shoddy service while I'm waiting to post this schedule? And does it address, is it an equal if somebody, and we move up within our company very much so. My dishwashers make some of the best cooks, but sometimes that takes a year to 3 years. But are they ready the minute something evacuates or somebody quits that they can walk into that position? No, they cannot. But will I train them and develop them? Absolutely, I'm going to spend the time for my employees. I'm invested in them, very much so.
Thank you. I appreciate your question. Representative Barreto.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I really appreciate your testimony, and I think businesses that recognize that it's a win-win situation between employees and the employer are usually the most successful. But I was going to ask you, sir, you said the restaurants that you work for are starting to move out of state. Are they planning on moving all at once or just growing out of state?
At this stage, it's growing out of it. We started with one. This would be 7 years ago. We opened our third. The third one has a second anniversary coming up next month. Our fourth location is now going to be out of state, and very disappointing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Kinnemer.
Thank you. Follow-up, Mr. Paz. Out of state, do you mind specifying which state and maybe some key reasons?
Minimum wage, tip credit. Matter of fact, that's an
only some, the unimportant ones.
Yeah, well, tip credit, wage equity. Given my experience in Oregon, I've been able to make a really good living, take care of my family. It's a single dad with three. But the new minimum wage, that's going to be a killer. That's just going to kill us. I make my money from tips, which is performance-based. If I do a good job, I'm going to get that gratuity. But for my employer to stay in business, for them to also let me do the tips and the minimum wage, employers can't afford to do that. They just can't. So I have to lean towards the fact that maybe it's time Oregon started thinking about doing a tip rate at wage equity.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And that's coming from somebody who was against it for most of my career. So now with the new minimum wage, no.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony today. Thanks a lot. Up next, I was going to have Susan Hills, Rebecca Camberley, and Kate Newell. Well, since, go ahead and get started. We'll see if Kate shows up, evidently.
Okay. Do you want to start? Okay. Chair, Vice Chair, members of the committee, my name is Susan Hills. I'm actually going to be testifying on behalf of a friend of mine today who was unable to be here. He's had a surgery. He was here last week and hoping to testify. I'm going to go ahead and read his testimony exactly as he wrote it. My name is Ronald Hemmerling. I'm a veteran on Social Security disability and have worked in the engineering department at the Red Lion on Hayden Island for over 10 years. For me, there are a few typical work days. Over the years, I have worked both scheduled and unscheduled days, mornings as well as swing shifts, and have even been asked to sleep at work in order to keep equipment running. I've repeatedly asked my department head to allow me to train other employees to do my job, but it has never seemed to be a priority. I wind up covering shifts when people suddenly quit, get fired, are ill, or go on vacation, but I've had to fight to get through my own vacations or illnesses without being asked to come in and resolve issues. In 2008, I had half a lung removed due to lung cancer determined to be caused by Agent Orange exposure. I've also been diagnosed with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, hypertension, and back and neck problems, which are serious enough to require surgery. My employer is aware of my physical limitations and the restrictions on the amount of hours I'm allowed to work per SSDI. However, knowing this has not stopped them from continuing to move my schedule around, scheduling me for back-to-back shifts, or attempting to schedule me for more hours than I'm permitted to work. Furthermore, being a veteran, I use the VA medical system and need to make all of my appointments. Knowing roughly what my schedule is going to be ahead of time is imperative, as some of my specialty doctors are scheduled out as far as 6 months in advance. I urge you to please support House Bill 2193. Thank you.
And if we could get Derek Dutra to come up and join this panel, that'd be great.
Good afternoon. My name is Rebecca Camberling, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association to urge you to vote yes on HB 2193. One of the goals of OLA is to fight for the rights of employees who face discrimination in their work based on race, gender, disability, sexual orientation, or religion. This bill will help address discrimination against a group of workers who otherwise can be subject to bias by their employers and their managers. From working parents who need to schedule child care to disabled individuals who need predictability for things like doctor's appointments, as we just heard from Mr. Hemmerling's testimony. These people may otherwise face singling out due to their specific status. HB 2193 also provides a fair and equitable mechanism for enforcement to make sure that the employers and managers abide by these rules. OLA supports the efforts to make workplaces fair and urges you to vote yes on HB 2193. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Derek Dutra, and I'm here to support the Fair Work Week bill. When I first began working at Harbor Freight, I was under the assumption that I would have a fairly solid schedule of between 30 to 40 hours per week. As I soon realized, my availability was expected to be 40 hours, but I rarely work more than 25, and sometimes as few as 12 hours. Our schedules were supposedly printed on a weekly basis, yet we're susceptible to shift changes on an almost daily basis, often without notification. I literally started checking the printed schedule on every one of my shifts just to make sure that I was not caught blind. This level of uncertainty when it came to my schedule made it difficult to plan any aspect of my life more than a day in advance sometimes. The uncertain amount of hours meant that there were times when me and my coworkers had to resort to different avenues to supplement our income, since it was difficult to find a second job when our own work schedules were up in the air most of the time. One of my coworkers would even donate plasma sometimes to make ends meet. If the shifting amount of hours were not enough, my vastly varied start times of shifts, anywhere from 1 a.m. to 11 p.m., wreaked havoc on my sleep schedule. There was at least one instance where, while working a 5 a.m. shift, I was informed that my 5 a.m. shift for the following day had been moved to 10 p.m. that very evening, which meant that I was most likely going to be getting only an hour or two of sleep during the afternoon, if I was lucky. In fact, due to how erratic shift starts were, I averaged about 3 to 4 hours of sleep per night for over a year. No employee should have to go through that. I thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Catch up in there.
Oh, yeah. No.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. Sorry, I was running down from another committee hearing, but thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony in support today of House Bill 2193, which would protect many employees from unfair scheduling practices that undermine their ability to provide for themselves and their families. These protections are particularly important to women, who make up nearly 65%
Could you identify yourself?
Oh, did I not? Sorry. Kate, for the record, Kate Newhall with Family Forward Oregon. Again, apologies for running into the room. We believe these protections are particularly important to women who make up nearly 65% of the 271,000 workers in Oregon's low-wage workforce, where these scheduling practices are the most common. As you've heard, unpredictable scheduling happens in a number of ways. It happens when employers give their employees a work schedule with just a few days or hours notice. It can mean receiving a work schedule that is subject to frequent changes with little notice and disrupting an employee's out-of-work responsibilities. And the thing that springs to my mind most often is childcare. As we all know, childcare is expensive and you have to have planned for it in advance. When workers don't have access to work arrangements that allow them to care for themselves and their families, many get pushed out of the labor market or into jobs that are way below their skill level. This is particularly true for women, who are more likely to be in part-time, low-wage work, in part because unfair scheduling has forced them to choose between work that meets their full earning potential or work that allows them to care for their family and their family responsibilities. We believe that Oregonians are not just workers, but they're also family members, caregivers, and contributing members to our communities who need to be able to rely on regular schedules, have the opportunity to arrange work schedules around some caregiving responsibilities, and to be able to predict their paychecks. For some families, that might mean that they have a flexible schedule so that they are able to meet caregiving needs at home. For other families, it may mean that they have a predictable schedule so that they are able to keep a child in regular and consistent child care. We believe House Bill 2193 is a very reasonable approach to addressing some of the worst types of scheduling practices. While the main provisions only apply to large employers in specific industries, we think it's a targeted approach that will have a direct and very positive impact on thousands of workers who struggle with the most unfair scheduling practices. Family Forward believes that all workers should have adequate notice, advance notice of their schedule, be guaranteed some measure of predictability, and be protected from retaliation when requesting an alternate work schedule. We support House Bill 2193 because it will improve how employee schedules are managed with the goal of making it possible for employees to reasonably predict pay and plan their lives. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess to the whole panel there, do you find it that your attitude and willingness to do something is better if you're incentivized and rewarded or forced into doing something?
Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, I think that I see where you're driving with this question, and I guess what I feel like is that there needs to be a basic floor of standards that everybody is meeting and allows that nobody can be taken advantage of, frankly.
And to add to that, those employers who are already doing a good job, they're not going to be penalized for continuing to do a good job. This is literally setting a basic premise that people have to follow.
Yes, absolutely, they could be penalized because of the way the bill is written. Even if they try and do their best to work with the employee, they are still penalized if something happens beyond their control, but yet they still have to pay more for the employee.
Well, if it's beyond their control, I'd need a little bit more specificity to answer sure. that. I'm sorry.
Well, you could just same
follow up.
Thank you. No, you could say weather related. You could say volume related. You could say, what the demands are for this certain period of time. You could say electricity goes out. A lot of different things. So,
Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, I guess what I would say is I think that the provisions in this bill allow for I think what is a pretty reasonable penalty when situations come up like that. I don't think that it's excessive, and I still think that it allows employers to, in certain instances, call people in with shorter notice. And I think, to me, that seems very reasonable to have some measure of predictability pay that comes up when there is a shorter time frame that you need to call somebody in.
Representative Heck.
Thank you, Chair. Having worked retail for years and having been a mom with kids, I just think it's important that we also tread lightly and carefully because we certainly don't want to hurt the very people that we are intending to help mm-hmm. by limiting what employers can and can't do. You heard some of our restaurant folks testify earlier to the fact that, what if they want those hours and they want to be able to be called in? And what you've done in this bill is make it so difficult for employers to be able to do that I think it's so far to the extreme that you have actually, I think that we have the unintended consequence of hurting those that we're intending to help. And I beg to differ that the employer has the benefit of doubt, because the way I read this, they're guilty until proven innocent. And I guess the question to you would be, do trial lawyers benefit from this bill? So is it just about employees, or is it a benefit to you all, too?
It's not a benefit to us. It really is. We're here for the employees. If employees are being injured, that's where we come in. We're not the enforcement mechanism. That's not who it is. So we don't benefit from this in that we're going to get a whole bunch of business out of this. This is really what we try and do is we listen to our clients, we listen to the workers, and we hear the stories and the problems that they face. I've had clients call me where they're being scheduled for double backs because somebody's mad at them, and so they're working these insane hours, and there's nothing they can do
but
about
can I have a follow-up?
Through the chair, just please.
Follow-up. When I worked retail and I worked like the night shift at a pizza parlor and then I opened the next morning, and I think the one gentleman talked about that too. If we did I think there's a 10-hour shift, I wouldn't be able to have worked the morning shift. So I'm just saying, I just would hate to see us hurt those that wanted to be able to work those shifts. I know for me, I went to school, that worked for me, and I would just hate to see us have an unintended consequence and actually hurt some folks that wanted to be able to pick up extra shifts or wanted to work those back-to-back shifts.
Chair Holvey, Representative Hack, if I can, I also do just want to clarify one piece. I mean, I think for the employees who do want to pick up additional shifts and consent to a schedule change in a shorter time frame, then there is no penalty for that. And I guess I also sort of think about the cost that employees are incurring when they have things like child care arrangements that they have to figure out. They have medical appointments that they have to get scheduled. And I think a lot of times the costs of those services far outweigh the costs of the the predictability pay that you would have to do to call in an employee in a shorter time frame than is what's allowed in the bill. So I just sort of weigh those. I think a day or a couple hours of child care is a far more expensive thing.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kinmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kate, just a kind of a comment, but I'd be interested in your comment. Sherry and I have a favorite restaurant we like to go to, and it was interesting to me. We went there about a month ago, and we had to wait probably 15 minutes to get a table in a fairly large place. And another Friday night, about 3 weeks later, we go, mm-hmm. and there's no wait. In fact, I'd say less than a third of the tables were full. I just find it hard to know how people are going to know to schedule the number of employees that takes.
Chair Holvey, Representative Kinmer, I think that is a difficult situation, but I also think it's a conversation to be having with your employees. I mean, I think in those instances, I remember times when I was a server myself, I might consent and be willing to go home if there's no tables for me to be taking in that time.
But excuse me, Mr. Chair, follow up. But under this bill, there are no provisions for that mutual agreement if you're asked to leave early. And I guess the other part of that, another piece of this, Mr. Chair, is, I'm thinking about one of my granddaughters who works for a large restaurant or a chain restaurant, and she's a student, and she loves that flexible schedule, and they call her because she gets to make lots of windfall money. And, you know, with this schedule, that would put a substantial amount of her income that's helping her prepare for college go away.
So, Chair Holvey, Representative Kinmer, I do believe that there is a provision to allow for schedule changes in a shorter time frame if it's mutually agreed to by the employer and the employee.
I'd like to know where that is in the bill. Somebody can find that.
Yeah, we'll look for that. I had a similar question, I guess, to Representative Kinmer, as you know, we'd heard testimony earlier that from the employers that, you know, this would take away their ability to get somebody on short notice, or to change things because of weather or things like that. And I thought that the bill accommodated those situations. Do we have an answer to that?
I believe it does. I mean, I may be mixing it up with the Senate bill that's of the same nature, but I understand there to be special provisions for weather or any other emergencies that may come up,
mm-hmm.
as well as being able to pick up on-call shifts. I thought that was a possibility.
I don't know the answer. Has the Senate discussed amendments in committee on this bill at all?
I don't believe they have.
Yeah, so we're sort of talking the same. Pretty much. Representative Doherty, did you have a question?
Yes, and actually it's on I guess it's a definition on in the bill, because in the summary it goes through, and later on it said it requires the employer to pay employee equivalent of at least 4 hours of work if employee is scheduled or called into work, but due to employer does not work entire shift. What's the definition of due to employer? And the reason is there are, I mean, because all of a sudden we have 5 feet of snow, is that because of the employer? If we have no electricity, is that because of the employer? I'm confused as to, I guess, who the blame is or something, if it says in there that if you, if it's due to the employer, you have to pay. And I'm not quite sure what that means.
Chair Holvey, Representative Doherty, I'm going to let others that come behind me testify to that. I mean, I think in my mind those are decisions made by the employer, and I guess I don't see the power outage or the weather instance as a decision.
So that could be excluded. Things kind of active.
But again, I'd rather let others coming behind me testify to that piece.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Might be a good idea. So we'll try to get to some others now. Thanks a lot for your testimony. Appreciate it. I'm going to have Sean Miller, Betsy Earls, and Ann Kramer. Prommer. And so far, we've been keeping relatively on schedule. People have been taking a little less than 5 minutes apiece, so hopefully you can match that.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries, Oregon Business Association, and the Oregon Retail Council. AOI, OBA, and the Retail Council has significant concerns with House Bill 2193, which, in our opinion, would impose rigid scheduling mandates that reduce the flexibility for both employers and employees, and they would significantly impact our members' ability to manage their store operations. Our members share your interest in addressing their employees' needs for predictability and flexibility when it comes to scheduling. Our members who fit the bill's definition of large employer have different methods of working with employees to shape the best schedules, but none of our large employer members are without any policy or practice at all in this important subject area. Many employees choose to work in retail because it allows them to work a flexible schedule. Offering this kind of flexibility allows us to attract a diverse and talented pool of team members, from college graduates starting their career to adults looking for part-time work to students or retirees. Under this proposal, employers will be less likely to make changes to their schedule, such as adding hours for employees or accommodating last-minute employee requests due to the penalty pay provisions that you've been discussing. The bill does appear to provide exemptions to the extra pay and make-up pay requirements under some circumstances, but it doesn't really address the less predictable issue of customer demand. And a really good example is one of our franchise members last summer had the city putting in new sidewalks in front of his store. The city did just about everything they could to provide access to the store while they were under construction, and the store owner put out signs saying open during construction. Nevertheless, customer demand slackened. And in this situation, the employer just didn't have enough work for employees. They sent one person home, and under this bill, that wasn't something that was necessarily due to the employer, due to the employee, due to the city or whatever, but that's a situation where they just didn't have the kind of demand that they normally would and would probably end up costing them money. So there are numerous examples like that throughout the bill that we have concerns about. I can spend more time another day going into those, or we can do that, you know, one-on-one. But I think for now I'll just let my colleagues take it.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I'm here today on behalf of the Northwest Grocery Association, and we are also opposed to House Bill 2193. And you heard from my colleague about this, that we do also believe it's these onerous statewide scheduling mandate punishes the employers and their employees. I wanted to point out something I provided Jan today that is a policy comparison. It's on OLIS. Between the most recently adopted Seattle ordinance and House Bill 2193 and Senate Bill 828, it does show just the policy differences between what was enacted up in Seattle and what's proposed today. And I wanted to, you know, I won't go through all of those, but I do want to point out one in particular, and that is the lack of a collective bargaining agreement exemption. And that's on page 9 of the document I provided. The CBA exemption does not solve all of our members' concerns, but those stores that do collective bargain with its unions, scheduling is a part of the negotiating table, and it should continue to be part of the negotiating table. I've also heard, if you look at section 17 of the bill on page 11, there is a reference to collective bargaining agreements in this section. And I've heard reference that this is an exemption. It's not. All this is that it's intended. Nothing is intended to create an additional remedy for an employee if that remedy is equal to or better than the remedies in sections 3, 9, and 10 required by a collective bargaining agreement. So that is not an exemption. That's just dealing with the remedies that have to exceed what's in this bill. And so I wanted to point out the differences there. That's a key difference in other areas that have enacted this. While we oppose House Bill 2193, we do believe that the local preemption on scheduling mandates should continue. In 2015, the legislature passed Senate Bill 968, which would put a two-year preemption on local scheduling mandates. You know, a permanent preemption, we feel, is necessary this session to prevent, again, a patchwork of these burdensome scheduling mandates around the state in different localities. And so, again, from the business community standpoint, we're looking at extending that permanently this session. So that concludes my testimony, Mr. Chair. I'm happy to kind of talk through some of the other issues in that policy document, but I did want to provide that and point that out. That's how all of us. Thank you.
Yeah. We got a lot to get through for sure.
Yep. I have a question.
Go ahead.
My name is Annie Kramer. I live in Northeast Salem. Dear representatives, I'm a sixth generation farmer here in Oregon, farming with my father and my brother. We farm year round, keeping our blueberries growing and healthy. Our harvest seasons last about 8 weeks, and that's if the summer heat or the rains don't take our crop out. Berries Northwest hires about 20 to 25 full time employees. And then we have about 25 to 250 harvest workers. I oppose this bill because in our industry, we have many variables that impact our ability to be able to sustain schedules. The show-up pay for our full-time employees and our seasonal workers, we do our best to give them heads up on work schedules and picking schedules. Weather plays a big role, and we have no control over this. If we hear that there's rain in the forecast, we're talking to our pickers, telling them to call us before they leave in the morning. Me and my foreman are up usually between 2, 3, and 4 in the morning, making the call whether we can pick or not due to the weather. There have been times we've started picking for about an hour or two and had a big rainstorm come in. Once the fruit is wet, we cannot pack it fresh. It will then go to the process market, which will only give us about a third of the price versus fresh. We do our best to keep our crews working with the weather, cooperating and communicating as soon as possible when we have issues. How am I, as the farmer, going to be able to afford to pay 100 to 200 workers for not working due to something I can't control? Bowley says that I have to pay workers his or her average pay. My average picture makes about $15 per hour. And then $4 for show-up pay, say 150 workers, that's $9,000 in one day. It will only take a few days to put me out of business at this rate, or I'm just going to have to use machinery to pick my fruit into the process market, which I already do part of this with my crop. The right to a flex schedule. My seasonal workers already do this. About a quarter of them have other jobs. They'll come pick till about 11 or noon and then leave for the next job. And about half of them will remain picking for about 5-6 hours, and then once they're tired, they leave. The remaining will stay in the field until we call it a day. They choose their schedules as pickers already. Most of them work long enough to make the amount of money they want for the day and then go home. My full-time employees, I work with their schedules already. In the summertime when it's hot, they want to start earlier in the morning, and we do. In the wintertime is much harder due to only having 8-9 hours in daylight. With the notice, the record keeping, and the enforcement, we do our best at this time to fulfill our employees and seasonal employees schedules. The record keeping requires and enforcement will cause us to retain whether we continue to hire our own or begin using farm labor contractors that'll be able to do all the requirements you're asking. The requirements among the record keeping you're asking to do in this bill adds to the burden of what we already keep records for BOLI, DOL, Oregon OSHA, state and federal working records. In 2010, we had 4 days of weather over 103 degrees. Our fruit on the vines shriveled up. After 2 days of this weather, we had to call it quits for the rest of the season. For the above reasons, aviculture cannot afford HB 2193 due to the uncontrollable environments in our industry. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Kimmerer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Earls, in my reading of the bill, this also has something that hasn't been addressed thus far, and that is the notion of potential retaliation and a new standard that could be quite costly. Can you address, are you prepared to address that? When there's conflict between jobs, as I understood it.
Oh, certainly. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Representative Kenifer, I think what Representative Kenifer is referring to is the employee's right to negotiate with their or request a different work schedule based on a series of factors that they, you know, they could be subject to. And if you look, for example, at
Section six
of the bill.
Line one on page six.
You can see that an employer has to honor an employee's request for a change of schedule if it's based on this list of factors, and one of those factors is the employee's other work commitments. So you can end up in a situation where an employee is working for more than one employer, has two jobs. I've had two jobs. We probably all have had two jobs. And the employer has to honor the employee's request to rearrange their schedule around their work for another employer. And I think a lot of our members feel it's fundamentally unfair that they should have to accommodate the schedule and needs of another employer in a situation where the employee is working for both.
All right. I appreciate your comments, your testimony. One more question, Representative Hack.
Thank you, Chair. Sean, you brought up the collective bargaining issue. Do we know or have we had any conversation about the impacts of this on our state departments, our cities, and our counties? Because this wouldn't just apply to private business. I mean, this is something that has to happen at the I mean, every department in the state would have to do it. I mean, do we know if there's a fiscal for that? Our cities and our county folks?
We haven't ordered a fiscal yet.
Okay.
Yeah, but I would. Yeah, I don't know the answer, but we'll look into that.
Thank you.
So I'd like to bring up Mike Salvaggio and Chris Groner to finish this up for the day. On this particular bill. Go ahead and start.
All right. Chair Holdley, Vice Chairs Barreto and Bynum, for the record, my name is Chris Groner, and I'm here representing the United Food and Commercial Workers Local 555. We represent over 20,000 workers in Oregon and Southwest Washington. Our members work in several industries, including retail, meatpacking, and healthcare. We're a diverse group of workers that have grown into being the largest private sector labor union in Oregon. We respectfully urge you to support House Bill 2193 and provide working Oregonians with a fair work week. Far too often, workers in Oregon, especially those in retail, food service, and hospitality industries, are being scheduled in a way that gives them little to no control over their life. Many receive work schedules with very little notice, often less than a week, and sometimes as little as the same day. They have no say in their own work schedule. They do not know from week to week how many hours they'll work or even when those hours will be. They do not know what their weekly paycheck will amount to, what their life schedule will be, or when they will sleep, how they'll take care of their family obligations. These inconsistent schedules are wreaking havoc on family lives and economic security. Workers simply cannot realize the American dream when they only have a few days' notice of work schedule, when they don't have a predictable paycheck, when they can't schedule childcare or health care, and when, due to these employment practices, they are unable to go to school, get a second job, or start their own businesses. Unfortunately, many of these workers, although they would rather not, are forced to use our social safeguard like food stamps and Medicaid in order to survive. Employment is intended to lift people out of poverty and to keep them off of our social safety net, not drive them into it. At least that's what I learned in the Oregon school system. Oregon taxpayers should not be forced to foot the bill just because profitable corporations are trying to maximize profit, even when it means chaos for their workers. House Bill 2193 is a start towards solving these problems. This Fair Work Week proposal would bring stability to worker schedules while still allowing businesses the flexibility they need to operate. It gives workers more say in their schedules and more stability in their lives. Both employers and employees would have flexibility in scheduling. House Bill 2193 incentivizes adequate notice of schedules and provides compensation for employees' flexibility in situations where short notice schedule changes are necessary. It gives workers a reasonable number of hours between work shifts to rest, both for their health and for their safety. House Bill 2193 provides the opportunity for workers who want to work more hours with their current employee, the ability to actually receive those hours if they're available. It increases the possibility of workers moving toward full-time employment and potentially increased employment benefits. Fair Work Week is about respect and dignity. It's about giving hardworking Oregon families a sense of security and leveling the playing field for employers who are already doing the right thing. It's about work-life balance. It's about a fair economy that works for all Oregonians, about finding ways to strike a balance between the needs of employees and the needs of employers. It's about moving workers off the social safety net. It's about the American dream and the ability of all Oregonians to achieve it. Today, I'm here on behalf of the members of United Food and Commercial Workers Local 555. We're encouraging you to support House Bill 2193. It's about respect. Thank you to the members of the committee for my opportunity to testify today.
Thank you. Mike, I'm going to kind of hit my mark here. You can either speak for a minute or two or come back at a different date. I'll let you decide what you want to do at this point.
I'll just go as fast as humanly possible.
Okay, go.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Michael Salvaggio. I'm here representing the Workers' Families Party. There's some inconsistencies in testimony that I just want to correct for the record. There's a lot of testimony regarding worker flexibility. I want to be very, very clear that Section 10, Subsection 2 does make clear exceptions for workers who request or consent to various scheduling changes. It was brought up very recently by Representative Kennemer regarding the Section 6 requirements. Will employers have to make certain changes according to certain circumstances? There's going to be a Dash 1 set of amendments coming out very soon where I believe that is going to be addressed. Most of Section 6 you're going to see is gone because it you're right, it is fairly flexible. It's a little bit, I think, bridged too far in this particular bill. Still good policy, but not something that we have to have in 2193. In terms of Representative Barreto's concerns regarding weather-related electricity goes out, et cetera, if you look at, again, Section 10, Subsection 2, if you look at that little paragraph H operations can't continue because there's a lack of utilities. That would cover the electricity going out. Also, the issue of an employer's work shift cannot continue or begin due to the recommendation of a public official. That's the subtle way that we get at weather, because if we just said bad weather exemption, then the bill would never take effect because it's Oregon. And lastly, I'd just like to say that the, you know, I'm a business owner in my other life, and I consider myself an entrepreneur, and part of that is that I take on certain risks. There are going to be circumstances where I'm not going to be able to count on a particular number of customers coming in every day. That's what entrepreneurship is, and that's what capitalism is. And frankly, if I was able to count on a particular number of customers coming in every single day like clockwork, that's not entrepreneurship. I don't know what it is, but it's not that. As a business owner, I don't expect my employees to take on that risk for me. I take on the risk, and I pay myself the dividends, and that's the trade-off. My employees, they get paid for coming in. They get paid for meeting their schedule, and that's the way that we feel it ought to be in the state. And frankly, when the state sends me a court summons for a parking ticket and says, you need to change this at least 2 weeks beforehand, that they're telling me I need to know my schedule 2 weeks ahead of time. This is the state telling me I need to know my schedule 2 weeks ahead of time. What we're asking for is that the state recognize that need for every worker.
All right. Thank you for your testimony today. No. We do not allow applause. I hate to tell you that. Yeah. So thank you very much for your testimony. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2193. And I'm going to stand at ease just so people can depart that aren't here for the other bill. To
because I was just buying.
I'd like to reconvene the House Committee on Business and Labor. We will be carrying over House Bill 2348 to Wednesday. So with that, I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2191.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is a measure many provisions in it. I'll try to go quickly. Requires a person obtain a license from the Secretary of State in order to serve as the commercial registered agent in the state when they are serving more than 50 persons. Specifies that the principal office of a business entity incorporated or organized in Oregon or authorized to transact business in Oregon must have a physical street address that may not be commercial mail receiving an agency. It may not be a mail forwarding business or a virtual office. Authorizes the Secretary of State to investigate alleged or potential violations of business entity statutes. Permits the Secretary to impose penalties or seek dissolution of the business entity when it violates statutes. Permits the Department of Revenue to recommend dissolution of the business entity that fails to comply with tax laws of Oregon. Subjects directors, officers, employees, members, and managers of business entity to claim for damages from a person that suffers ascertainable loss of money or property resulting from knowing dissemination of materially false statement concerning certain aspects of the business entity's finances and operations. Permits the Attorney General to bring action to enjoin business entity from continuing violation of business entity statutes or to seek judicial dissolution. And finally, it requires corporations and LLCs to either file a document declaring that they have or that they will file a tax return in Oregon or to list the information of the beneficial owners. There are no amendments today.
Thank you. And some committee members may remember this topic from sessions past. It is a topic that actually was before the legislature in 2007. Back a while where we actually had the FBI testifying in front of the Judiciary Committee for the first time, I think, ever, or maybe the last time ever, as well. Anyway, it's a subject that has come and gone in the legislature, and we have never taken action to change the dynamics of what are referred to as shell corporations and the lack of knowledge we have about their operations and who they are in the state of Oregon. So just as that little primer, a personal primer, I guess, on the subject matter, I'm going to call up Cheryl Hemstra, John Groves. And maybe Kevin Demmer, I don't know if Deemer?
Yes, sir.
It's hard to tell who was supposed to go together here. So thank you. If you'd introduce yourself and give us your testimony on this fascinating subject matter.
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Cheryl Heemstra. I'm the Deputy Legislative Director for the Attorney General at the Department of Justice. I'm here today in support of House Bill 2191. With me is John Brew. John is the attorney in charge of our Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section. The state of Oregon is lucky to have John. He's also got quite an extensive background in criminal prosecution as well. Next to him is Deputy District Attorney Kevin Deemer from Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. So I'll just give a quick overview of sort of the policy behind the bill, and then John and Kevin will get into some specifics of what we've seen on the ground. So yes, basically this bill allows the state to weed out fraudulent shell corporations. The way I see it from the kind of the 10,000 foot view is we've got a pendulum here. On one of the end of the pendulum is what was the case before we had corporations or LLCs, and that was total personal liability, that business owners couldn't take any risk without having, say, you know, their mattress get repossessed by the bank, right? They were on the hook for everything. On the other end of the spectrum, I would say would be complete immunity for fraudulent shell corporations, that they're able to layer themselves with so many layers of insulation that we're not able to go after them for the fraudulent use of their corporation or their LLC or whatever business entity they may have. Somewhere in the middle is where we're able to have business entities, have businesses be able to take good business risks, but have some accountability about who's actually behind these corporations. And House Bill 2191, I think, allows us to swing back a little bit further to the center. In 2006, the feds released a study, the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, and they flagged Oregon as one of four states that was very problematic for shell corporations. In the time since 2006, we've done very little, if maybe nothing, in response to that report. Wyoming, Delaware, Nevada, and Oregon were the states, and those three other states have taken action in their interim in their legislatures. We've done nothing. So I think it's high time that we take a look at this and try to tackle this problem in Oregon. As I mentioned, John's and Kevin are going to get into some specifics, but about the victims we've had of this. But I would posit too that one of the victims here is the state of Oregon itself. When we shell out a business license, an LLC or a corporation, we're saying the state of Oregon gives you this license, gives you this entity to do business in Oregon. We've heard in our financial fraud work of scammy companies saying something like, you know, we're a licensed business. We are licensed by the state of Oregon. And as of that's supposed to give the consumer some sort of reassurance that, you know what, I'm legitimate. The problem with that is usually, you know, these corporations are more of an insulation from actual responsibility than you know, a stamp of approval. You've heard from Jan what this bill will do, but I think what's probably one of the more important parts of the bill is that when we find abuse, we're able to weed out that company. We're as the Attorney General in the bill, we're able to bring into an appropriate forum and ask the court to dissolve the corporation or revoke their status in Oregon, and it gives us a good mechanism to do that. A little bit about the process. In December, DOJ met with former Secretary of State Jean Atkins. We suggested a few tweaks. Was very impressed with her work. She made a systematic study of what the other states had done to fix their problems. She, I think, came up with maybe seven or eight solutions and picked the best three, and those are what you see in House Bill 2191. So we have a group here today, I think, that's very supportive of the bill. We agree something should move forward. A decade is too long to let this problem sit. And we're happy to work with stakeholders on any amendment that might be coming forward. So with that, I'll turn it over to John.
Thank you, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. My name, again, is John Grew. That's G-R-O-U-X. I'm the attorney in charge of the Financial Fraud and Consumer Protection Section in the Oregon Department of Justice.
I've been in that position for about 3 or so years. Before that, I was a senior attorney within the section as well, and then before that, I was in the Criminal Justice Division. I've been a prosecutor. I've prosecuted fraud cases in Marion County, Linn County, Tillamook County, Coos County, Washington County, and it's run the full diversified realm. Ms. Keenster mentions this FinCEN report that I think might all be before you. I remember months back she came to me and we were chatting about the report, and it was new to me, and I said, well, I'm not surprised. I've been dealing with these shell entities for some time. I'm not a master of the language of bill writing, so I'm not going to go there. I do want to spend some time talking to you about how this operates and who the victims are. But if you're going to summarize the intent of the bill, it's basically this. Consumers, as well as other businesses in Oregon, you want to know who you're doing business with. You want to know, are you dealing with the real people behind this business, or are you dealing with something else, an illusion of some sort? So I didn't put this up here, this chart I gave to Ms. Heemstra, to give you a headache. But this was a worksheet. One of our investigators
was working.
I know. So it's a worksheet one of our investigators was working on, dealing with the telemarketing fraud scheme. And just very briefly, not everything up there is a shell entity, but what this investigator was doing was we had a number of complaints coming in from Oregon consumers, mostly the elderly, who got caught up in a scam of telemarketing fraud where they thought they could develop a business at home, a work-at-home model. And the scammer was basically saying, we can set you up. We can have you set up your own business here, and we can help move this along. It was one of those, I don't want to spend time on the scam so much as the fact that one of the ways they did this is they had these individual consumers who were going to become entrepreneurs set up a business entity. Once they had this merchant account set up, they were able to conduct credit card transactions, and these consumer victims / entrepreneurs were ultimately tricked into a fair number of transactions that would ultimately go back to the main culprit business entity that we dealt with. The main purpose of this chart was just to show how hard the investigation was tracing this down, because ultimately when we tried to find a target, these shell entities were thrown in front of the investigator, and it took a long time to drill down into that. Ultimately, we took on the business. We got to the heart of it. We were able to drive them from doing business in Oregon. They were returning nothing of value to these consumers. They were just using them to have this false front of a business entity. So that's one example. Here's an example of another case. I know it's hard to see that. My apologies. The chart itself is huge. This was the result of a racketeering investigation that I was actually involved with at the beginning stages in the Criminal Justice Division. This involved a business owner who was not only sold real estate but was involved in construction. And what this individual did is multiple frauds through the use of shell entities. And one of them was setting up a shell entity, and he had a team that he worked with that would be different members, registered members in this entity, and they would go to the bank and get financing, equity lines of credit, to basically finance further operations for other mortgages secured on other properties. But not wanting to get into the details of that scam, the way they use the shell entities is once they walked into the bank, banks always want to know, okay, who am I doing business with? This looks like an arm's length transaction. This business A, his, is doing business with this business B. Oh, the banks thought it was a different principal, so they saw their risk as minimal, and they were funneling this money to this individual. And this went on for a long time. What made this more complex and more nefarious was ultimately there were also victims that were involved in a price home flipping scheme. This was a pre-2008 collapse. A lot of this was occurring. This kind of activity kind of led to this collapse of the system. So if the next slide goes into some more details, what would happen is this team would use different addresses. They might have had three amongst them. And the team would also have different principals that would be registered owners on the corporation paperwork, and that's what they would present to the banks. And then what they did is they would bring in the unwitting party, home buyer, would come on board and buy this property, end up with an over-securitized mortgage, and then he would take this money and run with it. And one part of our investigation did involve looking into a lot of his trips in Vegas, where he continued further laundering activity through the casinos. So that gives you one picture of that. So if we can. this is another example, just the front page of a civil lawsuit from activity down in the Medford, Oregon area. The reason I'm showing you that is I'm showing this list of entities that were ultimately investigated by our office. And that was this one actually was in the press. Some of you may have recalled this. A lot of elderly victims receiving subscription solicitations from magazines that they thought were coming directly from magazines like Time Magazine and other ones, when in fact it was through these shell companies that were obscuring the fact that they were not Time and they were not these actual publishers. And they were hooking these people into these subscriptions at a higher price than Time Magazine and other publications would actually charge. So the publishing companies weren't really complaining because the subscription was coming, but it was coming through a middle person who was not revealing, the shell entity was not revealing that they were charging more than normally. So we ultimately brought a lawsuit against these entities and reached a settlement that did involve them leaving the state of Oregon. We did work with federal partners on this, as we have, and as we try to. One of the important salient points I want to drive home to you, though, is the federal law enforcement, while we work well with them, they are dealing with different economies of scale. Often what is a big deal to Oregon consumers and Oregon businesses may not be a big deal at the federal level. We are the local law enforcement, state, county, local, district attorney's offices. They're in the position to perhaps take action when they're taking on fraud. It's hard enough as it is. So anyway, okay, next one. Okay, so this one is an actual fake invoice that went to businesses. And I know from our section frequently, did you get one of the? So from our office frequently in our section, there's a kind of a common misperception that we never champion anything on behalf of businesses. But we actually do, and we've been dealing with, especially in the last 2 years or so, what we call the faux invoice scams. So if you could indulge me for just a brief second in a mental exercise. Imagine none of you are legislatures, but you're running your own small business, and it's mom and pop shop, and you don't know much about government and how it functions, but you're trying to do the right thing. And you're working hard, running your business, and late at night you're trying to pay the bills, and you're running through these bills, and you see this. This is from a fake shell entity. It was not even registered with the Secretary of State. It was registered through an individual in Florida. And what they did is they got a P.O. box in Oregon. They did not actually have a physical address, but they represented it as such. And they even made it look like it was being generated from the government. Now, if you're a small business owner, you're getting that, and you're saying to yourself, I got a bill. I got to buy this labor poster. Bang, you send it off. And you wouldn't be blamed for that. You would be truly fooled. And chasing this business down itself through, we have the ability to do it. We have to embark on an investigation. We have the resources to do it. But it was the regular consumer out there and the regular small business. They don't know what's hitting them. They don't even know who they're doing business with. It's an illusion. And so enough money pours in to these shell entities that are playing this type of game, and there's no recourse, ultimately. So that burden that's put on the business is pretty extreme. And now those who run businesses tend to be slightly more sophisticated in terms of these type of financial transactions. Regular Joe consumer, not so much. When they're dealing with that, they don't know where to go. So in anticipation, though, of one of the questions that sometimes is asked in these legislative committees, it's not like we have a tracking mechanism for shell entities. People don't call up the Oregon DOJ and say, I'm dealing with a shell entity, what do I do? What happens is they get scammed in some fashion, some way, and they don't know it's a shell entity. Well, all they know is they've been scammed, they've lost money, and it's not working out for them. We don't discover it's a shell until we start digging into it. And sometimes it's a lot of work, like those prior charts show, just to sort out who is who. It's to intentionally obscure. So one of the functions of the bill, as to the extent I'm able to ascertain, is to create clarity, just to show who you're doing business with. That's all that's really behind, ultimately, this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Representative Hovley and fellow representatives. Pardon me, losing my voice here. My name is Kevin Diemer, and I've been a prosecutor in Multnomah County for 18 years. About the last 10 of it, I've been handling complex fraud cases. Just want to show here this in relationship in the next slide you're going to see. This is a racketeering case that we're just now wrapping up in Multnomah County. We have about $1 million invested in this case. About half of that is state money from resources they gave us. These are the various companies that were involved with a car crashing scam where they were crushing victims' stolen cars, and they would be turning to confetti prior to the victim even knowing that the car's gone. They leave from work, their car's gone, they think it's stolen. Portland had an outrageous number of what's called unrecovered stolen vehicles. Normally, you report your car stolen, and it's recovered in the next 2 or 3 weeks, but it was off the scale, the numbers that they had. And the reason it's off the scale, they're not being recovered because they've been turned into confetti. Now, this next slide. There we go. Well, that's not as headache-causing as that first slide that you saw from showing that they're shell companies. But this is just the type of investigation we're doing with all those companies that I was showing you the list of. That's all on here. And from a prosecutor on these kind of cases, when I'm being involved, you know, after a victim's called the police and the police are contacting me, this is prior to them arresting anybody. When we're doing an investigation, and the point is that on the shell corporation, just like any other fraud, the point of fraud is to conceal what you're doing, to hide from the person what you're doing, or else it won't be a fraud. Why would you buy something that's fake? They're trying to trick you. And also make it like if the shell company was registered 10 years ago, then it looks like it has a history. And so in our investigation, just trying to find out, well, who actually owns this? And you might be familiar with it. There's actually a statute in Oregon that allows corporations and companies to be charged criminally, just like the charging document that you normally would see with the defendant's name being charged with the crime. You can charge a corporation. But in order to do that, you need to know who the people are, because the way the law is right now, unless you can prove who the principals are and who their attorney is, you can't just bring the corporation, which is an intangible thing, into court. You got to know who their true attorney is. And without having a proper mechanism, Secretary of State, to show, okay, this is the who this corporation is, this is who the registered agent is, and maybe if that person's an attorney, then you can bring that corporation into court. But as he was describing that, the scale for the feds versus the state, a lot of this has to do with, like, these companies, I can almost assure you we're not paying taxes. But from the feds' point of view, and we discovered they weren't paying taxes, unless they're getting a recovery of $500,000, meaning we know they ripped us off on federal income tax, but unless we're going to be able to retrieve $500,000, the feds do not want to touch it. Hmm. Well, I don't know what the state's criteria is, but if the loss is significant in the federal system, but not significant enough, it's still serious enough for us. And a lot of, again, the shell companies, if they're doing fraud, they're not paying their taxes.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Heck.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for all your work on this. What a daunting task. I just had a couple questions as it relates to the fees. And I didn't know if these are existing fees or if these will be new fees. I know it's $100 to register your business. But on Section 3, there's a non-refundable processing fee of $500 for each location at which the person will accept service. Is that a new fee?
Chair Holby, Representative Hack, I believe that would be a new fee. Part of the bill we didn't really highlight in our testimony is the commercial registered agent piece of the bill. So there was this Portland Business Journal article that went into depth about this. There were about 1,500 companies located at this one house in Alola. They were basically just the corporate registered agent for a bunch of these businesses. And so what a piece of the bill does is it says, okay, if you're going to have 50 or more of these businesses registered under your registered agent name, you need to be licensed by the Secretary of State. So that's what the licensing piece is in the bill.
Can I have a follow-up?
Follow-up.
And then in Section 4, let's see. Section 5, sorry, the $100 non-refundable processing fee. So that's when you terminate. Is that a new fee also?
Chair Holby, Representative Hack, I believe it is because it, again, has to do with that commercial registered agent piece, and that would be a new licensing.
Okay. Thank you, Chair.
You bet. Representative Doherty.
Okay. The question I have was the visual that you had of, like, people getting magazines and so on. And I noticed on there they had a credit card number that you could put in. Have any of these scammers also gone through, alleged scammers, gone through and done credit card fraud also? Or do they pretty much just want to take your money and run?
Chair Holby, Representative Doherty, that wasn't the scope of our investigation.
Okay.
Ours was primarily focused on, with the subscription, primarily on the consumers that were getting roped into that. We didn't go so far as looking into the actual credit card fraud.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you for your work on this. I have received that labor law poster many times. And never choose it. My question is, can this type of fraud, this shell corporation type of fraud, happen even if you don't register with the Secretary of State or register through a registered agent? People can come from out of state, do business, but never say they're going to legitimately do business here, right?
Yeah. Chair Hovey, Representative Bynum. Yeah, absolutely. It's happening all the time. And, in fact, that particular labor law poster case, they weren't, they had done nothing in terms of filing with the Secretary of State's office. And I would say half of our fake invoice cases, they haven't registered at all. The other ones have. The ones that have, frankly, it is quite helpful to know something as opposed to nothing. But then the scant detail in terms of the something we know is puts us at a great disadvantage, as well as the consumers and the small businesses.
Thank you. So I have a question myself. You mentioned FinCEN, and we've had Lane Shetterly from the Law Commission in front of this committee over the years about how they're working on this issue at the national level with NACUSL, and I'm not going to try to tell you what it stands for. I hate acronyms, but I have to use it this time because I can't remember. It's a national uniform law something or other, but anyway. And they sort of made reference to, we really don't need these laws because we have FinCEN where we can get all this information. And when I tried to look into that, not everybody can get access to that information from FinCEN. And I think it's a little bit harder to get to than I was led to believe.
Chair Hovey.
And tell us what FinCEN is, too, for
Financial
example.
Crimes Enforcement Network. Am I getting that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Way to go.
one of the exhibits I had up there where I mentioned the individual had gone to Vegas to celebrate his winnings, you know. I actually tried to access FinCEN and get more data because I was chasing down a lot of different accounts. Very hard to do. They gather a lot of intelligence. I don't want to speak too much out of turn, but they work with a lot of other federal agencies and law enforcement to provide what data they can. It is, of course, a lot is protected by the Bank Secrecy Act. And that's been in the relationship of the case I worked with the FBI, IRS, and other federal law enforcement, that is normal for the course. It is true, though, what my colleague mentions in terms of this 500K threshold. And we are frequently looking at these smaller cases in that regard. So actually getting to get federal resources to bear down on Oregon-specific activity, it is a challenge. And we work hand-in-hand with them. It's a harmonious relation with our office, but just bringing them on board, it takes a lot.
Could I also address that with FinCEN? As you may know, when you're working investigations, if you get information, you maybe are trying to do a search warrant later, you're not permitted to go to a court and ask for a search warrant with information you get from FinCEN, because you have to put in your affidavit the source. And so while your detective might know, okay, I know that's where the account is, they can't put in the affidavit, I know that my target has an account here because I learned that from this FinCEN record. One of the requirements when you access the database is that you won't refer to it in an affidavit. So while it can give you focus and where to look at, you've got to be able to back that up in another manner.
Mm. Interesting. A few hurdles for certain. I appreciate you opening up this subject matter for us. I don't know that we'll probably have more questions down the road. I know that there's a lot of people interested in this, and certainly there's probably parts of the bill that we may look at amending, because I know some folks would like to continue to look at this issue instead of taking action. But from my point of view, after 10 years of looking at it and not taking action, there should be some things we can do. So I hope you'll stay engaged in the conversation as we go forward. So thank you. And colleagues, just so you know, in OLS, I believe it's in OLS anyway, former Secretary of State Jean Atkins provided us some testimony on this particular bill. She did submit three other bills, as was referenced, that we're not hearing. And also, I'm going to make available to Jan an example of some of the issue the Homeland Security, U.S. Department of Homeland Security, and the FBI brought into the 2007 hearing on this issue, which was supposed to have gone to a work group, but which never happened, as the bill did not pass the Senate, evidently, as I found out. So with that, I'm going to bring up, I'm going to skip around a little bit, so I apologize. We have a little more time left. I did want to hear from Stephen Elzinga from the Secretary of State and you can just come up by yourself if you don't mind. I'm trying to think of somebody else that could come up with you, but go ahead.
Thank you. Chair Holby and members of the committee, my name is Steve Elzinga, and I'm the Governmental and Legal Affairs Director for the Secretary of State.
Could you speak up just a little bit?
Yeah, sure. Sorry. My name is Steve Elzinga, and I'm the Governmental and Legal Affairs Director for the Secretary of State. The Secretary of State strongly supports cracking down on money laundering, tax evasion, and other financial crimes. However, the current approach in House Bill 2191 needs significant additional vetting to ensure that it is complementary to federal solutions to this problem without creating outsized enforcement costs or unnecessary burdens on legitimate businesses. And just as a side note, I'd mention that former Secretary Atkins' testimony also includes information on how she believes additional work on this bill is needed. The broad scope of House Bill 2191 will have a considerable impact on the Secretary of State's business operations and workload, requiring 11 new positions, 11 FTE, as well as changes to business processes and computer systems. The overall fiscal impact is expected to be a little over $1.5 million in 2017-19 and over $1.8 million in 2019-21. Better targeting of the measures in this bill could help reduce these costs. A 2006 report, as noted before, from the U.S. Department of Treasury found that several states, including Oregon, were appealing for forming shell companies. However, what the previous testimony did not note is that when this report was updated in 2016, Oregon was no longer singled out as problematic. Further, Oregon should be careful to align with the changes made by the federal government since 2006 to help prevent fraudulent use of shell companies. In many cases, the federal government is best equipped to stop money laundering and tax evasion, especially schemes that rely on electronic money transfers. This is why the National Association of Secretaries of State continues to promote a federal solution to these type of problems, and President Obama's fiscal year 2017 White House budget included language concurring with the NAS approach for a federal solution. My written testimony, which is in OLS, includes details of the federal solutions that are already in place, which provide federal law enforcement agencies with a central repository of beneficial owner information through the U.S. Department of Treasury, thereby ensuring that beneficial ownership information is readily available for investigations related to fraud, money laundering, tax evasion, and corruption. House Bill 2191 still needs significant work to accomplish the goals that we all share. The Secretary of State would be glad to participate with all other interested parties in a work group to improve this bill.
Thank you. appreciate your testimony and the Secretary of State's willingness to participate, because we're obviously hearing a couple different things about whether that information is readily available for folks to enforce the law or not. So, you know, I appreciate the bill's not perfect, and very few bills are to start with, but I really would like to see if there is something incrementally we can do, because from what my understanding is, Oregon has not really updated or, you know, helped to solve this issue going forward, and does not rank very well in terms of the issues as you've mentioned. But, you know, there's lots of information to look at. So hopefully you can participate and seeing if there is something incrementally we can do about shell corporations in Oregon, because of the implications of fraud and money laundering and the such. So I don't see any other questions. Thank you for your testimony.
Yeah.
I'm going to bring up Chris Allman and Chris Hall. And let's go to Jesse O'Brien, maybe. Oh, yes. It's going to be very short. Somebody may get left out off of this, and we'll carry over some of this conversation. So anyway, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Chair Olvey, my name is Chris Allman for the record, and I appreciate this opportunity. This is the first time I've ever come to this committee for a hearing, let alone give testimony. I've been to education committee hearings, health committee, and this testimony was 6 months of my work. In the past 6 months, I have been delving into and trying to understand complex financial transactions that start with a business that is doing legitimate business here, Regions, Cambia Blue Cross Blue Shield, and giving you context for this. My interest came up because of Measure 97, and I saw that they were put $550,000 into that opposition. And for good or bad or whatever, however your feelings about it are, is that I thought, why? I mean, I don't get it. This is a nonprofit company. And then I started down into this exercise of looking at the Secretary of State's website to understand that, because while it and Cambia are Regions and Cambia are nonprofits, there's no 990s, and I thought that's so odd. And then I decided, well, okay, I'm going to make a formal complaint to the AG's office. And I had this back and forth eventually with Doug Pearson, who basically threw up his hands and said, well, here, you can look into this and that and take a look at this tax record. And I looked at the tax record, the property tax record for 100 Market Street, and I'm like, huh, it doesn't even have Regents on there. It had CSHV First and Market LLC. And I thought, well, that's really odd. And I wondered, who is this company? And I couldn't figure out much from there. And then I started looking into more and seeing that CalSTRS was actually the it's California State Teachers Pension Plan, is actually the owner of the building, or was, and they use this shell, if you will, company in a very odd, what's called bargain and sale deed in 2013, purchasing the building. And I thought, well, this is really odd. But moreover, as I looked more in the property records, I found out, in fact, it was sold again this past year in Halloween. So in a mere short few years, and it basically doubled in price. And I thought, this is really bizarre. So I called then and spoke with Dina Mendelson at Consumers Union. I'm trying to think, well, what are these Blue Cross companies? What are they all about? Because it turns out in 2014 that California revoked their nonprofit status. Well, it turns out that in 1987, there was a change in the federal tax code. And at that point, Blue Cross lost. They became known as a, quote, stock insurance company, but they had a special designation when it came to their federal taxes. They paid less in taxes. They paid, had deductions that they could take off. They were called a 501M. Okay. Any of you here heard of 501N before? Well, it's the kind of thing that allows them all these deductions, allows them to lobby, allows them to do donations to political campaigns, gives them all these kind of advantages. And moreover, Oregon, they don't pay taxes to Oregon Department of Revenue. All of which made me wonder, well, I don't understand all this. How is this insurance company getting away with this? At the same time, it's noted they have five times the surplus necessary. So what I started seeing in the theme of all these businesses that are involved here is a registered agent. And I began to think of them as having this invisibility cloak, basically, the capacity for which one is not able to understand how a business is actually put together. I sent an attachment to you about Cambia's business structure, and it's kind of like what the big business thing right. that you saw.
I'd like to get somebody else's testimony. I think you have described to us something that the Attorney General's office also described, this making our heads spin about how complicated these things can be.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to do that. But my point is, there, it's not just these illicit companies that we're worried about. It's white-collar crime I'm worried about, and potential for tax shelters, and all these Delaware-based companies that we cannot follow the money. And I
agree.
So thank you.
I want to thank you for coming and giving us your testimony. If we got just a couple of minutes left, if you could sum something up in about 2 or 3 minutes, that would be great.
Yeah, so. That's all right. Didn't expect it to be quite this long, so I'm glad to get it done. My name's Chris Hall. I'm a partner with the law firm Perkins Coie. I just kind of look at this. I work with the bar, kind of legislative committee, the business law section of the bar. I'm not here on their behalf because didn't get go through all that hoops to do all that, so I'm not really representing their position, but I'm neutral on the bill, whatever you know, I understand this has been out there for a while and you want to do something. So really my kind of point of being here is if you do go forward, I do hope there's a real opportunity to make some amendments to the bill. I think there's some real practical applications. You know, this does apply to legitimate companies doing business. For instance, just give one example of how this works. An employee of the company has to, every year under the penalty of perjury, say who all the shareholders are, where do they live, and give a copy of their ID. Some, without any obligations of shareholders to tell them that every single year. Obviously, as we know, some, as we saw the charts, you know, you got shareholders of shareholders. So somebody's got to know and figure that out every single year under the penalty of perjury when they certify it. You know, some of our companies have hundreds of shareholders. They have, you know, dozens, and, you know, Nike's part of this. You know, they all have these obligations, and there tries to be some limits in it to try to not to be every single shareholder. I think that's the intent of the bill, which is all fine, but I just think we need work on making sure that practically the companies who are here, that you want to be here, are able to comply and feel comfortable that it's not overly burdensome for what's trying to be accomplished. And as long as we have an opportunity to spend some time kind of working on those type of things.
Yes, I appreciate that, and I know the State Bar has expressed concern about how this bill moves forward. I know there's a lot of discussion about reviewing a lot of the corporate structure statutes and things like that, and which is a real comprehensive undertaking. And happy that that's, you know, going to be looked at. But we will, you know, have a further discussion and make sure this goes forward with the input that's needed to make sure we don't step on too many toes while we're trying to get to where we need to go. And I'm going to have to end. We'll carry this bill over to Wednesday as well. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2191. Nothing else for the business. I'm going to adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor.